Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to Taiwan On Air, 空中直播 Taiwan. Hello everyone, this is Zhang Dihan, one of the hosts of our Taiwan On Air podcast series. This podcast episode is sponsored by Helsinki Environmental Humanities Microgrant. The University of Helsinki is currently supporting projects which focus on global development of environmental humanities. And we are glad to be bringing our Taiwan On Air podcast also as part of this larger project. So today, we are here for a book chat relating to Taiwan eco-translation. Our special guest of the day is Professor Daryl Sturck from University of Lingnan in Hong Kong, who is known by many working on Taiwan and read about Taiwan. Today, Daryl is not only an established academic, but also a high acclaimed translator who specializes in contemporary Taiwan eco-literature and indigenous studies. Like many others, I came across Daryl's translation through Wu Mingyi's novel. I was back then a doctoral student, working on my thesis argument through Wu Mingyi's post-colonial eco-writing such as 睡眠的航线, Roots in the Dream, 敷衍人, The Man with the Compound Eyes, and 天桥上的魔术师, The Magician on the Skywalk. And I remember in 2015, when Wu Mingyi published The Stolen Bicycles, 单车世界记, I thought, wow, this is an amazing book I must include in my dissertation. So I began to translate parts of the novel that myself needed. But just before I completed the writing of my thesis, Daryl already made the English translation available for the international readers. And it was such a great work that at the end, he had pulled out this work so amazingly, I have to revise my own work. But it wasn't until very recently that I had the actual opportunity to work with Daryl directly, with the invitations from another scholar, Ian Rowan, from National Taiwan Normal University, Shida. The three of us began to work together and co-edit for a translation anthology of contemporary eco-literature. We include works from indigenous eco-literature, ocean writings, climate fictions, and speculative indigenous fiction. Throughout that process, I have personally learned a great deal from working with Daryl directly as a translator and also as a translation editor. And I must say that I was very, very impressed by his rigorousness for translation and the attention to details how a translator should perceive the work both as a reader and a second author. I'm really looking forward to seeing that anthology coming into print in the coming year and to be part of the collections of the National Museum of Taiwan Literature. There are simply too many renowned works that weren't translated by Daryl. To name a few of his works that are commonly known by international readers, apart from Wu Mingyi's The Man with the Compound Eyes and The Stolen Bicycle, there is also Sakinu Alonglong's Hunter School, Sanzhu Feizu Sajinu, Kevin Chen's Ghost Town, Gui Difang, Igor Yan's Ground Zero, Ling Didian. And I know that recently Daryl is also working hard on a translation of a semi-autobiographical novel for the famous indigenous writer, Xiaman Rampongan. I think I'll stop my introduction here and let our special guest to say hi instead to our podcast audience. Welcome to our Taiwan On Air, Daryl. 欢迎.
Thanks. It's nice to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
So, Daryl, I'm going to start with questions related to your career to be a translator, or how you say, as an eco-translator. Knowing you a little bit, I noticed that you have made quite some different choices throughout your undergraduate to your postgraduate studies. I read somewhere that you did English literature as an undergrad student in your 20s.
That's right. I have a degree in English Lit.
Yeah. And it was back then you started learning Mandarin Chinese.
It was in fourth year. I was 22 years old when I started learning Mandarin for the first time.
Oh, right. That's very early, actually. And in 1990s, you said that you moved to Taipei and taught English there. But I seem to see that you also switched to biology and chemistry. And although your MA PhD focuses specifically in East Asian study and with a particular emphasis on indigenous people in Taiwan, it wasn't directly related to translation somehow. So my question is that, can you tell our podcast audience a little bit more how you ended up being a Chinese English translator, and more specifically, why eco-translations in Taiwan? I'm curious why you choose a path working predominantly on eco-translation, and how would you define eco-translation in your own way?
Great question. Well, after graduating from University of Alberta with a degree in English literature and then spending a couple of years in Taiwan teaching English, I came back to Canada, or went back to Canada, and had a midlife crisis and wandered through biology, chemistry, organic chemistry, thinking I was going to be a doctor. And then I ended up taking linguistics classes and finally classical Chinese. And that took me to the University of Toronto, where I did a master's thesis on Suzhi, poems about Zen Buddhism, which I translated into English and talked about. And I became a translator a few years later when I was teaching, or rather translating, study plans and reference letters. You remember those?
Right, I remember.
Businesses on Nanyangjie in Taipei, just south of the train station. I worked in one of those sweatshops for a year and eventually started translating all kinds of things, technical, legal, medical, military, anything they threw at me, I tried to translate, whether I knew it or not. And so in the process of translation, I tried to learn a little bit more about everything under the sun, including biology and chemistry. And how I got into eco-translation was really through translating Umingyi's Fuyanren, because I know you know the novel well. So throughout the novel, he's referring to different flora and fauna in Taiwan, different species of plant and animal. And it's easy for me to look these things up. So there's a species of damselfly or a species of a fig tree. But to be honest, at the time, I had no idea what a damselfly was. And I couldn't have pointed out a fig tree to you. So I kind of felt a little bit ashamed of myself for being able to translate these things without really knowing what they were. And so I got obsessed by the fact that I didn't know the things I was seeing around me every day, especially natural creatures. And, you know, in Umingyi's novels, you're supposed to observe plants and animals and have this idea that they're observing you, right? So you can kind of identify with them. And like, they've basically, even a plant has basically got the same problems that you do. It's got to survive. It's got to reproduce. It's got to try to leave something behind. So I started getting to know plants and animals and then adopting this this idea that they were looking back at me, and that we actually had a lot in common. So eco-translation in the past couple of years has been about me trying to become a naturalist here in Hong Kong. So I'm going to do a project about eco-translation of Hong Kong and other Sinophone cities, basically just using bilingual websites and field guides about different aspects of nature. So there's a plant field guide, there's dragonfly field guide, damselfly field guide, beetle field guide, and it's all bilingual. And so I'm just curious as to why the people that produce these field guides and websites, why they did it, and what challenges they had when they were doing it, how readers have been using it. So that's the one project. For eco-translation, the other project is I'm looking at Saitic ethnobotany. Saitic people are in Taiwan, one of the indigenous peoples in Taiwan. And so they're translating their traditional knowledge, which was an oral tradition, and it was a practical tradition. So they knew how to do stuff and they could talk about it, but they didn't have to talk about it. They just demonstrated their know-how. But nowadays they're writing it down in Saitic, their ancestral language, and they're also translating it into Mandarin. And so I'm interested, to what extent does this translate? To what extent can you translate concepts from Saitic tradition and contemporary Mandarin? And that the question I ask now when I'm doing this kind of eco-translational study.
I see. Okay. So it's very interesting because you were saying that about the translation on Saitic language. I knew that previously you also did the film translations for Saitic Ballet, if I'm not mistaken.
You're not mistaken, but I would prefer to say that I studied the film translation for the movie. The translation was done from Mandarin into Saitic by Saitic elders who have now passed on.
Okay.
Very sadly. I started doing this project studying the translation of the Chinese language screenplay into Saitic about 10 years ago. And the people I worked with when I was doing the research for that book have passed away now. So I was studying how they translated from Mandarin to Saitic, and I discovered that when he was doing the screenplay in Mandarin, the director, Wei Desung, is also the screenwriter, he included translations from Saitic that were recorded in the 1910s, 1920s, and 1930s. So in a way, when he commissioned translators to translate his screenplay from Mandarin into Saitic, those translators were translating back into Saitic about 100 years later.
Right.
So that's the project I was doing for that book.
It was a sort of a double way sort of project. It's not necessarily from Saitic and then being translated again to English, but it's more like from Mandarin it was written and then translated back to Saitic, and then you put part of it in English.
That's right. But I didn't translate the subtitles into English. It was somebody else. That was more grist for the mill, you know?
I see.
I was mainly focusing on translation from Mandarin into Saitic.
I see. Interesting, because it seems to me like you are very fascinated in your early stage on more like film and representations and indigenous studies. Do you see that eco-translation sort of combined also this part of the indigenous multiverse, pluriverse, that we can say, that in your ways of working through translation?
I think so. When I'm looking at these plants and animals, I'm imagining them looking back at me. Maybe that sounds a little bit crazy, but after translating Umingi, I kind of got into the habit. And I think children, you got children, right? So children always have this idea that, a stool here and a chair there and a tree across the way might all be sentient in some way. They're all animists. Anyway, I also imagine myself being like an indigenous hunter 150 years ago. Because the thing about indigenous hunters is that in order to hunt effectively, they got to notice all kinds of stuff when they're going through the wilderness that ordinary people don't know. The wilderness for them is full of signs, and they know how to interpret the signs. So I can't do it. I'm not an indigenous hunter, but I imagine myself being one, or tried to look at nature the way a hunter might. So sometimes when I'm wandering through the bushes in Hong Kong, I'll see scat, I'll see animal shit. And so you can identify it sometimes. Some animals will shit like in the middle of a stream, so they can't be followed, because if they shit elsewhere, it's along the trail and then they can be tracked. And I found porcupine quills. And porcupines, it turns out, are really important to the way an ecosystem turns out. If there's porcupines there, they're going to root around, and it's not going to be dense bushes. But I live on an island here called Lama Island, and we don't have porcupines, and so the bush is really dense. You can't walk through the bush unless you bushwhack. Indigenous people, for me, and I think this is why I studied them, have always represented this deeper understanding and more intimate, practical understanding of nature that growing up in Canada, I never got. Like, I grew up in a suburb. I never paid any attention to trees and animals around me. Not a concrete jungle, but to, like, the park across the street was the closest I got to nature.
Me too, in Kaohsiung.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm sure, strangely enough, our upbringings have a lot in common. And so since I started researching Indigenous people and translating Umingi, it's like I've been led back towards nature, trying to understand what it's all about and figure out a healthier relationship with nature.
That's fascinating. Like, I see why you are like sort of more and more into the genre of fictions and then through Umingi as well. So shifting our subject to more on a book, because this podcast, we meant to pick a book to talk about. I will be mainly focusing on Umingi's The Stolen Bicycles, Umingi's Man Booker Prize long-listed novel. I remember that talking to the French translator of Xiamen Ranpoguan, Damien Ligo, he said that when he translated the Tao indigenous language inside of this work, he used a French Creole in order to represent different language, but written in the Sinophone, sort of like a written language structure. As a key reader of Umingi's work, we know that he also employs a variety of different languages to showcase the cultural and linguistic diversity in Taiwan. And of course, it is also the case in The Stolen Bicycles. For example, Japanese, Daigi, Hoklo, and from time to time, a couple of vocabulary here and there from indigenous people's languages. And he's more sort of polyphony type of like incorporating all these. Can you tell our audience what is then your strategy to translate when you're dealing with these sort of non-Mandarin Chinese texts or specific terms?
Well, thank you. That's another great question. And I'm glad you told me about Damien's strategy of using Creole, because Gwenaël Gaffrique said that he did something similar when he was translating The Man with Compound Eyes into French. And if I thought I could have pulled it off, I might have used some sort of South Sea Polynesian Creole based on English. But I think it's easy to strike the wrong note if you don't really know the language. And so I can try to sound like somebody from Texas, or I can try to sound like somebody from Polynesia.
Yes.
I can try to sound like someone from the Appalachians, but if I'm not from there, I'm probably not going to quite get it right. So ultimately, I would stick to what I know in terms of sociolects of English or idiolects of English. Like sociolect is a way of speaking that belongs to a certain social class. Idiolect is a way of speaking that belongs to a certain person. So I'm just dealing with the resources that I've got in English. Umingi can include Japanese daigi and so forth in his novel. But I mean, I grew up in a pretty monolingual environment. My grandparents were Dutch speakers. And, you know, there are parts of England where Dutch was spoken, maybe not today, but it was spoken in centuries past, because a lot of Dutch people ended up migrating from the Netherlands to England. But I'm not from there, and I don't know Dutch. So I wasn't going to be able to kind of replicate the distinction between Mandarin and Taiwanese with English and Dutch. So basically, in The Stolen Bicycle, when the protagonist's mother is speaking to him in Taiwanese, I just imagine what my grandmother would have sounded like speaking in English, right? And so she should sound like a mother or a grandmother with a similar kind of background to the protagonist's mother. She's not an educated lady. She had lots of kids. She worked really hard during her life. She suffered a lot. So I tried to make her sound like somebody like that.
So it's the tonality, like, sort of accounts in a way.
That's right. It's a big challenge to get people to sound natural when it's scripted vocabulary. When we watch a movie or when we're reading a novel, the vocabulary is invented by one person or maybe a couple of people, if a translator worked together with somebody else or the writer worked together with somebody else. But it's invented, so it's not entirely natural, but it's got to somehow sound natural. So that's the biggest challenge of all. In terms of representing the diversity of Taiwan linguistically, I can use romanization. So if it's a word in Japanese and it's a Japanese speaker, then I try to use the Japanese romanization, and the same point goes for Taiwanese. And of course, I have to tell the reader what this means, but I can indicate that this was in a certain language. And I got an example from The Stolen Bicycle. Yuanfen is a big concept in Chinese for many people. It's this idea that things are destined to happen or fated to happen, personal relationships, especially romantic relationships. And so I had Yuanfen appearing three times in the novel, one time in a Japanese context, one time in a Taiwanese context, one time in a Mandarin context. So I wanted to spell it three different ways in the three different times it appeared in the novel, but my editor didn't let me. I had an editor at the publisher, and so she let me put in a lot of Taiwanese in romanization, but she didn't let me get away with that. I also wanted to spell, Taipei. Taipei has been spelled all sorts of different ways. It's been Taihoku in Japanese, and Taipei with an H at the end in the Qing Dynasty, and Taibak in Taiwanese, and Taipei, of course, in Mandarin. So I wanted to spell it all sorts of different ways to reflect the linguistic background and the period of the novel. But again, my editor wouldn't let me, because she was worried that it was going to make it more difficult for the reader to understand.
I can see that, definitely. But sometimes presuming a different sort of readership, it's difficult to like manage everything to be translated in the way that we want it to be. So following that question, I was going to ask you, do you or do you not prefer to have translator notes? Because in neither of the non-novels of Wu Mingyi, especially that for international readers who are not very always like familiar with Taiwan history during the Second World War, one could argue that The Stolen Bicycle could have benefited from some translator notes to summarize the complexity of the dynamics in relation to the country's colonial and also environmental history. Why did you decide not to include this? Is it because you think that anyway, the story can speak for itself to represent itself in that sense?
Great question. I think listeners have to keep in mind that you can blame the translator when things don't go right. But when things do go right, you have to keep in mind that other people might have been making decisions. Like my wife will often share her opinions about my translation with me. And, you know, my grandmother, I still remember how she talks. So my grandmother's behind some of the decisions I make as a translator. And then at the publisher, there's the editor that tells me you can't spell Taipei five different ways. And the proofreader might also have opinions. So it's not always the translator's decision to make. And in Fuyinren, The Man with the Compound Eyes, I just did not have an opportunity to write a translator's note. The person that decided that they wanted to publish the novel left the publisher before I submitted the translation. And the new person at the publisher was not very enthusiastic about the novel and did not have it copy edited. It was just proofread. And I didn't bother asking, can I write a translator's introduction? Because I assumed the answer was going to be no. They wanted to do things as cheaply as possible. But I'm happy to say that it came out pretty well.
Yeah, it came out really well. Well responded in the market.
Thank you. Yeah, it's gratifying to hear that 10 years later. And with The Stolen Bicycle, I did get to write a translator's note. It may not have made it into the first edition.
Ah, I see.
But there's a second edition published about 6 months after the first one, or 8 months after the first one. And I think you'll see a translator's note in that. And it's two things about the translator's note. One, it should go after the novel. So it's not like the reader has to take a course in Taiwan's environmental and political history before they can appreciate the novel.
Yeah,
I think, number one, we shouldn't underestimate readers. And number two, the second point I was going to make, is that it's not the purpose of a novel to educate the reader about Taiwan's environmental and political history. And I think readers can figure it out as they go along. The main point of a novel like The Stolen Bicycle is to get people to care, to get people interested. And if they're interested, then they can go on to look things up for themselves.
It's also their discovery process.
That's right. That's right. So U Mingyi has done his job. I've done his job. If the reader ends up interested in the story and caring about the characters and the larger themes that he or she is dealing with. So in the translator's note that I put at the end, I just talked about a couple of issues that I thought might have been confusing for the reader, and kept it short and sweet.
I see. I didn't expect that you can show like that. My copy was a very old copy, I suppose.
Maybe you got the first edition. Yeah.
Yeah, I did get the first edition because I had to for my thesis. I see that we're running almost out of time for the interview. So I just wanted two very, very short questions on doing translations or eco-translation today. One is that how do you navigate in doing eco-translations while there is AI in the world competing? And if you can you quickly pick a book that you want to translate in the future if you have the possibility, the golden work that you haven't translated?
Right. ChatGPT is, of course, changing everybody's workflow, including translators. A lot of us get ChatGPT to do the first draft, and then we post edit. But in my experience, it's too fiddly. It changes the paragraphing.
Yeah.
And that's a big problem for your translation. If you want to check the translation, you got to go paragraph by paragraph. And you got to spend all this time making sure it aligns properly, because ChatGPT will change it. And I try numbering the paragraphs, and then ChatGPT says, oh, you're asking me to do too much at once. So I still prefer to site translate with the dictate function on MS Word. And that way I get really intimately familiar with the text. If ChatGPT does it, then I still have to get to know the text in the process of editing. or post-editing what ChatGPT spits out. And who knows what ChatGPT is going to be like in 5 years or 10 years. But a couple of things, it doesn't have a body like us. It doesn't care like we care. And it fundamentally does not get what communication is about in language or in images. It's a statistical prediction machine. So it has a totally different relationship with language than a translator does. So I'm here hoping, and I believe that there's still a place for human translators going forward. As for a book I'd like to translate, two books come to mind.
Yeah.
One is called Tongwang Shijie de Ziwu. Have you heard of it?
Oh, right. I heard about it. I haven't started it, but it was on Wu Ming's recommendation reading this.
Yeah. Yo Zijie is the author, Brendan Yo.
Yeah.
And it's about plants that grow in Taiwan's mountains and their connections to plants around the world. So have you heard of Edelweiss, the pale yellow flower that blooms at 2,500 meters above sea level in Switzerland?
And yes. The
made famous in the Sound of Music.
Yes, Sound of Music.
There's a distant relative of Edelweiss that grows in Taiwan. You can go to Hohansan to see it and Yushan.
Oh, right.
And these two kinds of Edelweiss, ultimately, they come from the Himalaya. So in Tongwang Shijie de Ziwu, he traces how over tens of millions of years, this kind of flower has managed to make it to Europe in the West and Taiwan in the East. And it's called Biogeography. The book is basically an introduction to biogeography.
Wow.
And I think there's something poetic about that you're looking at this pale white flower at 3,000 meters above sea level on Huanshan, and it's got a distant relative that's managed to survive over tens of millions of years in halfway around the world. The other book I would like to translate is Wu Mingyi's new novel, which is called He Ping Fen Dian, and or Fen Guan, I can't remember, but I've been asked to translate it. It's about cement mining in the area around the Taroko Gorge, which you may know is traditionally or ancestrally, that's where the Truku people are from.
Yeah.
They speak a kind of Saitic. And so that's the language I've been studying. And there's a lot of Saitic in the novel. And I got to kind of review the Saitic in the novel.
Oh, right.
Before it was published. And it's kind of about different ways of relating to mountains and nature in general. We can extract cement, or we can extract the raw materials for cement from it, as with Asia Cement and other companies which mined the mountains around the Taroko Gorge, or we can try to relate to it more like Truku people did traditionally.
With the two giants.
Where the mountain was their hunting ground, which they knew intimately and respected, and they had to do so in order to survive.
Well, that's lovely. Like, I do hope that you get to translate both of them. I'll be very keen on reading them, both in Chinese and in English. So with this, I would like to thank Daryl for this wonderful interview today. I'm very delighted that we get to talk to you about eco-translation, especially in Taiwan literature, in our podcast series. I believe this is a rising field that from now to the next 5 to 10 years will continue to boom as an important cultural production for Taiwan. We look forward to more of your eco-translation in the near future and hopefully to get you back to talk about another book when you finalize them. Thank you so much, Daryl, for coming to join us at 空中直播 Taiwan. We hope to meet you on air next time.
Thank you so much. It's been great talking to you.